You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. Today is a special edition of Future Talk done in honor of Earth Day. Some of you may be aware that I, Dr. Future, a.k.a. Dr. Paul Tenery, was the person who organized the first Earth Day back in the late 1970s at Queen's University. The first official Earth Day was launched in September of 1980, and I thought I would first give a little bit of background to that event and how it happened. The way it happened is that I regularly used to drive Highway 401 between Montreal and Kingston, between my home and university. And I remember looking out the window and seeing all the garbage that people had thrown out of their car windows onto the meridian, the green meridian of the highway. And I just remember just having an epiphany saying, I'm tired of this. Why doesn't someone clean this up? And then it occurred to me that someone should be me, that why should I wait for someone else to clean up a mess when I was perfectly capable of doing it? And so when I got to Queen's University, I simply grabbed a garbage bag and walked out to the highway and then started cleaning up the garbage until I filled up several garbage bags full, and then I properly disposed of them. The next year after that, the Boy Scouts, Girl Guides, Brownies, and so on, a number of community groups joined with garbage bags, and we just started cleaning up the garbage along the roads and the highways, and that's all it was. And it was always meant to be an active participatory event. Then I decided to organize the first formal Earth Day in 1980 in September, and I managed to get a lot of local politicians involved. For example, the mayor of Kingston, the principal of Queen's University, Flora MacDonald, the MP for Kingston and the Islands, and she became the original official chairperson of the Canadian Earth Day Society, which I started in 1980. And for those of you who are interested, you can go to Wikipedia and see a picture of the original festivities of Earth Day. And also you can go to YouTube and see the original video showing my speech at the time and the politicians giving their retort and explaining the importance of Earth Day. Anyway, at the time, what were the major problems identified? Apart from the garbage along the highway, which is what started Earth Day, the main identified problems at the time were ozone depletion, and this was caused by chlorofluorocarbons being released from refrigerants and going into the upper atmosphere, and then parasitizing the atoms in the upper atmosphere that were the ozone atoms that were molecules that were protecting us from ultraviolet rays. Since that time, the substances, chlorofluorocarbons, have been banned through the Montreal Protocol of 1990. The complete ban came into effect in the year 2000. And since then, there's been a marked improvement in the ozone layer as the chlorofluorocarbons get cleaned out of the atmosphere. So there's an example of a problem identification. followed by a discussion, followed by a solution enacted, followed by beneficial results. Back in 1980, acid rain was a serious problem. Sulfur dioxide from the burning of coal, oil, nitrogen oxides from coal, oil, and vehicle exhausts form acid rain. And some very acidic rains fell around the world during the 1970s and 80s. However, the efforts to remove sulfur from fuels and emission controls have been very successful. And there's been a remarkable reduction in the production in acid rain. And so the damages that this has been causing to forests and so on around the world has been reduced remarkably in the span of 30 to 40 years. So there's another success story of a problem identified and something done to solve it. Deforestation. Forests once covered 75% of the planet's land area. However, the figure is now less than 30%. Tropical forests once covered 14% of the land, now less than 7%. And deforestation was a very serious problem. However, laws have been passed to limit the amount of deforestation, especially of tropical rainforests. And the actual situation has improved. Even though deforestation does continue, it is going at a lower rate than it was in the 1980s. So we've seen some improvement there. And we've also seen serious replanting of forests going on around the world, which is helping the situation. A serious problem identified in the 1980s was species extinction. And at the time, probably between 50 to 100 animal and plant species were being extinguished every day, with the rates rising rapidly at that time. Tropical forests contain 70 to 95% of all the Earth's perhaps 30 million species. However, it was pointed out that if these forests were depleted, cut down, then millions of species would have no place to live and would be lost forever. So at the time, it actually seemed hopeless that we were destined to lose most of the species of the Earth. However, very aggressive protection of forests, reforestation of clear-cut areas, and species protection has been quite successful, and we've actually slowed down the rate of extinction significantly lower, probably from a 50 to 100 animal and plant species being extinguished down to maybe one or two. And so this is still unacceptable. It's still an improvement. Another very important area that was identified in 1980 by the Earth Day participants was toxic chemicals. With over 70,000 chemicals in common use, with 500 to 1,000 new ones being added annually. From 1945 to 1985, the production of synthetic organics in the United States rose 15 times to 100 million tons or more. And the U.S. National Research Council estimated that no information on toxicity available for almost 80% of the 50,000 plus chemicals listed by the EPA. It was estimated in 1980 that pesticides and herbicides kill 10 to 40,000 people annually in the developing world, the traditional dumping ground for chemicals banned in the West. For example, the breast milk of Nicaraguan women has been shown to contain DDT at 40 times the World Health Organization tolerance limit. Pesticides on food in the United States could be causing 20,000 additional cancers per year, but this is not an estimate. There's no certain way to calculate that. And their persistent use led to some resistant strains of pesticides. And so on. So things were looking pretty bleak in the 1980s, but there's been an enormous effort since then to reduce the number of toxic chemicals, to reduce the toxic residuals on food, to introduce more organically grown food, to find alternatives to herbicides and pesticides. Like, for example, in California, there's been an effort to introduce, for example, using high-temperature steam to kill weeds that are growing along with crops, and also to use a vacuum system to aspirate pests off the leaves of plants. This requiring no chemical additive, and then grinding up the resulting collection of insects for food for other animals, like farm animals. So there's been enormous progress in toxic chemicals, even though we're nowhere near an ideal situation. Things are better than in 1980. The next problem identified by the Earth Day group in 1980 was desertification. At the time, every year, desertification claimed over 6 million hectares worldwide, and with another 20 million hectares being degraded annually. The UN Environmental Program judged that 4.5 billion hectares, or 35% of the world's land surface, to be at risk of desertification in 1980, including about 66% of Australia's agricultural land. In 1980, worldwide, over 24 billion tons of topsoil were washed away annually. The principal causes of degradation were overgrazing, overcultivation, waterlogging, salinization, and deforestation. For example, in 1950, about 280 million Africans kept 272 million heads of livestock animals. By 1987, 604 million Africans had 443 million animals. The real root of the problem was excessive population densities and the displacement of poor people to on more fragile lands. But all of the worst examples of soil degradation can be reversed. In China's Laos Plateau, 10 million hectares were stabilized in 7 years from 1979 onwards. Trees and pastures were planted, and about almost a 20% greater crop was yielded from half of the useful crop land. So this shows that environmental impacts such as desertification can be stopped and reversed. And in the 30, 40 years since the first Earth Day, we have seen a remarkable progress in halting, for example, the advance of the Sahara southwards into the equatorial rainforest. And there's numerous women who have been awarded Nobel Peace Prizes for their single-mindedly working to plant trees everywhere in a wide belt across the southern edge of the Sahara to prevent the advancing sands from invading agricultural lands further to the south. So once again, since Earth Day 1980, we've seen an improvement in desertification. Things are getting better. Another problem identified in 1980 was water depletion. Farming accounts for about 70% of global water use, which through irrigation underpins the large food output necessary to feed more than 5 billion people. The function, however, is now experiencing severe constraints. Project costs, the costs of canal schemes in India, have doubled in real terms between 1950 and 1980. Salinization, 24% of the world's irrigated land has been damaged by the buildup of salt. Social and environmental costs, increasing local and international opposition to large schemes such as China's Three Gorges Dam project, which ended up displacing almost a million people. Scarcity, worsening water shortages in North and East Africa, China, India, and Middle East, and due to falling water tables in the U.S. Because of water shortages, the result has been declining output per head. For world grain, this fell by 7% from 1984 to 1989, a trend that has helped stimulate mass famines in some parts of the world. So here we have another problem identified in 1980, water depletion, and this is serious problems that I believe has not been properly addressed. Water tables to this day continue to fall around the world. Droughts are a serious issue. For example, they were in California until recently when they had a flood. But in many parts of the world, they've had, such as in the South Sudan, Ethiopia, they've had droughts lasting over 5 years, and with resulting damage to the agricultural economy. So this, in my opinion, is one of the most serious problems, even worse than climate change, is water depletion. And this is one of the issues that will become one of the primary issues of the 21st century. And I believe that water will replace oil as the primary valuable fluid of the 21st century, because you can live without oil, but you cannot live without water. And so we're going to be seeing numerous wars fought over water and all types of political battles trying to address this issue. And this is why that one of the things I am working on is the development of a new technology for water desalination, which would be much more efficient and more energy efficient than some of the existing desalination schemes that are now in use. And so this is one of the things that I'm working on. So having looked at how the world has changed since 1980, since I organized the first Canadian Earth Day, what else can be said? On the global level, it seems obvious to me that the main problems remain with mostly hunger and poverty. Certainly, since 1980, we've witnessed great improvements, both in feeding ever more people and giving them more food and better food, and also improvements in bringing more people out of poverty. And also, these highly positive trends are likely to continue for the foreseeable future. There's still some 800 million hungry people around the world and some 1.2 billion poor people in the world. In terms of securing a long-term improvement of the environmental quality of the developing world, securing growth so as to live these people out of hunger and poverty is of utmost importance, since our historical experience tells us that only when we are sufficiently rich can we start to think about and worry about how to deal with environmental problems. Poor people simply are incapable of dealing with environmental problems because they're just concerned about where their next meal is coming from. So how can they worry about desalination or desalination problems with water or climate change or whatever? They're just concerned with getting enough calories to stay alive. Since 1980, in the developed world, we've seen great improvements overall, especially in the environmental area. These positive developments, however, do not imply that we do not need to do more. In many areas and over time, it will make good sense to invest even more in sound environmental management. And discussing air pollution, although particle pollution is probably lower now than any time since the 1500s, lowering emissions even further would probably be a wise use of resources, no understanding the problems that such air pollution causes. However, it has to be realized that investing in an ever better environment is only one of the many ways we can invest in a better world, and that we must prioritize the environment as we must invest in better education, better health care, better infrastructure, as well as improving conditions in the developing world. The central point here remains, if we are to make the best decisions for our future, we should base our prioritizations not on fear, but on facts. Thus, we have to get the proper facts in order to confront our fears. And this is where, in my opinion, the greatest problem lies, is that many people are using faulty facts on which to base their great decisions on. And therefore, the decisions themselves are useless because they're based on faulty information, faulty facts.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC, but it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We're continuing our look at the first Canadian Earth Day that was organized in September 1980, and this is being presented by Dr. Panare, a.k.a. Dr. Future, who was the organizer of the first Earth Day back in the 1980s. Now, according to many people, many of whom shall remain nameless, we are on the brink of doomsday. There's an entire army of environmental organizations that have warned us of an impending end of the world. Of course, this message has enormous social and political impact. Former Vice President Al Gore's Earth in the Balance is an excellent example of the mood. And the opening paragraph of this conclusion states plainly, modern industrial civilizations, as presently organized, is colliding violently with our planet's ecological system. And this is not all, Gore insists. For sure, the destruction of the world's rainforests, of fertile agricultural land, of the ozone layer, and of climate balance is terrible. But Gore actually informs us that these calamities are only the first of a steady stream of progressively more serious ecological catastrophes that will be reportedly showered down upon us. At the same time, Gore insists that the loss is not only in the environment, but also within ourselves. We have lost our natural contact with the earth and become strangers to our own existence, says Mr. Gore. In his own words, quote, the pursuit of happiness and comfort is paramount, unquote. And according to him, we have ended up concentrating on the, quote, consumption of an endless stream of shiny new products, unquote. Well, he is one to talk. He is the one who owns more automobiles than virtually any other politician in Washington. I believe at last count he had 12 of them. Talk about shiny new products. Gore goes on to tell us that we have constructed a false world of plastic flowers and astroturf, air conditioning and fluorescent lights, windows that don't open and background music that never stops, sleepy hearts jump-started with caffeine, alcohol, drugs, and illusions. According to Mr. Gore, we have forgotten our direct experience with real life, as if he should know. Our civilization has achieved not only the destruction of the world, but of ourselves. That is indeed a dysfunctional civilization, to use Gore's terminology. And consequently, Gore sees this civilization as the new antagonist, just as Nazi Germany and communist totalitarianism were for the previous generation. It is not merely in the service of analogy that I have referred so often to the struggles against Nazi and communist totalitarianism. Because I believe that the emerging efforts to save the environment is a stimulation of these struggles. And this is the reason why we must make the rescue of the environment the central organizing principle for civilization, according to Mr. Gore. The real state of the world. But this vision and its political consequences are born on the myth of in the environmental catastrophe position, seeing that the world is on the brink of doomsday. Gore's The Environment about a dysfunctional civilization and the loss of a direct experience with real life reveals both a scary idealization of our past and an abysmal arrogance toward the developing countries of the world. The fact is, as we've seen, that this civilization has, over the last 400 years, brought us fantastic and continual progress. For most of the last couple of million years, we have been on the planet. We've had a life expectancy of about 20 to 30 years. During the course of the past century, we've more than doubled our life expectancy to almost 70 years. Infants no longer die like flies. It is no longer every other child that dies, but now it's 1 in 20. And the mortality rate is still falling. So in other words... it is actually not the fact the world's population is not rising because we're multiplying like rabbits. It's because we stopped dying like flies. We're no longer almost chronically ill. Our mouths are not full of stinking, rotting teeth. We're not covered in festering sores, eczema, scabs, and boils. We have far more food to eat than we need, despite the fact that the Earth is home to far more people. The average inhabitant in the developing world now has 30% more calories than their parents. The proportion of people starving has fallen dramatically from 35% to 18%. And also, this share is expected to continue to fall further in 2020 to under 10%. By that time, we will feed more than 3 billion people more than adequately. Of course, there's still going to be hunger and starvation, but it'll be a much smaller percentage of the Earth's population than ever before in history. We've also experienced unprecedented growth in human prosperity. In the course of the last 40 years, everyone in the developed world as well as the developing world has become more than 3 times richer. Seen in a longer perspective, this growth has been quite overwhelming. Americans have become almost 40 times richer in the last 200 years. People have gained far more amenities, from clean drinking water to easily accessible telephones, computers, and cars. People are now better educated in the developing world. Illiteracy has fallen from 75% to less than 20%. And the standard of education in the developing and developed world has increased tremendously. As regards to university education in developing countries, by almost 400% in 30 years. We have more leisure time, greater security, and fewer accidents, more education, more amenities, higher incomes, fewer starving people, more food, and a healthier and longer life. This is the fact. This is the fantastic story of the human mankind's achievements. And to call this a civilization of dysfunctionality is quite simply immoral on Gore's part. In the developing world, there are still many who lack the basic necessities and for whom growth and development are not an inconsequential experience of plastic flowers, microwave food, alcohol, and drugs, but a very real chance to live a decent life with the possibilities of choices, reaching beyond the concerns of getting enough to eat. For the industrialized world, growth and progress have given most people a life that is much better, and people now have enough time and resources to consider what they want to make the most out of their lives. Ironically, Al Gore's dress down of all of society is possible because growth has liberated us and him sufficiently from our physical limitations to actually allow us to give us the possibility of choosing, even if this choice is to turn one's back on present-day society. Insofar as Gore simply wants us to consider whether we would not be happier shopping less and living more, leave the mall and visit friends, or go for a hike in the wilderness, take up painting, his commentary is naturally unsympathetic and serves a reasonable reminder. But Gore goes much farther and tells us that we live superficial and phony lives, that our civilization, our parents' generation, have indoctrinated us into living this dysfunctional life, and that we cannot see the prison walls that surround us. We are repressed without being aware of it. This kind of superlicious attitude is a challenge to our democratic freedom and contests our basic right to decide for ourselves how we lead our lives, so long as doing so does not bring into collision for others. So I'm going to continue looking at the real state of the world. As the organizer of the first Earth Day, I take great pride in what the scientists have done to reduce our impact on the world, to reduce our environmental footprint, to make development more efficient, to decouple the growth and consumption of fossil fuels from the growth in GNP. There are many things we can be proud of. And I'm going to continue next show to talk about how people like Al Gore are completely wrong about their pessimistic view of the future. And rather, I'm going to give a more realistic appraisal of the future for my listeners to ponder. So thank you for listening, and I will continue this special segment on Earth Day next show.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby,